It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet an Oconomowoc man who rode his homemade electric motorcycle around Lake Michigan.
First, Governor Scott Walker said yesterday that he's open to appointing one of the three announced Wisconsin Supreme Court candidates to fill the vacancy created by the death of Judge Crooks.
Judge Crooks died in his chambers last week. The three candidates for the Supreme Court are Rebecca Bradley and Joanne Kloppenburg, both appeals court judges, and Milwaukee County Judge Joe Donald. Since Governor Walker's announcement, both Donald and Kloppenburg say they wouldn't apply for the interim position. Speculation has been brewing that Walker would appoint Bradley, the candidate backed by conservatives.
Jolly Emery is here to break down the story for us. She's the chair and associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Jolly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, what's fueling the speculation that Governor Walker will appoint Justice Bradley to the vacancy left by Justice Crooks?
Well, a few things. First, he's appointed her to positions in the past. So he appointed her to the Circuit Court, and then he the Milwaukee Circuit Court, and then he appointed her to the Court of Appeals position. So it's a trend, it seems, that he is, likes her as a judge. And so given that she's been sort of a favorite with respect to appointments, that she would, and she wants this position since she's announced her candidacy, that he could appoint her to this as well.
And what has Governor Walker had to say about the whole appointment issue so far?
Well, what he has said is he's tweeted that there's a precedent for this because Governor Tommy Thompson had appointed two people to the Supreme Court. And he's also said that, you know, this precedent is a solid precedent because those two appointees then ran for election and both won.
And on the other hand, is that what critics are worried about, critics of this sort of appointment, that there is sort of a leg up that you get when you're appointed and then you have to run later?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that there are critics who think that she will have people who would rather see someone else sitting in that seat, think that she will have an advantage. She'll have an advantage because she will be seen not necessarily as an incumbent, but certainly someone who's had some experience sitting on the court, as opposed to the two people that she'd be facing in the primary.
Now, Joe Donald, Joanne Kloppenburg saying they wouldn't accept an interim appointment, I gather, so far. Is there pressure here for all three of them to say, no, none of us will accept an appointment, so therefore everyone has a level playing field come election time?
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't know that there's necessarily pressure to do that. And it's not unusual when there's a vacancy on a state Supreme Court for governors to be able to fill that vacancy. Governor Walker said that he believes that there is a lot of work to be done on the court, and so therefore they need to fill Justice Crooks' vacancy. So it's not unusual for this to be done. It's not unprecedented, and there is a procedure in place. I think that it's interesting that neither one of them say that they will apply. You have to apply first to be appointed, and those applications are due, I believe, they close at 4 p.m. on Friday, this Friday the 2nd. And so you would have to submit a resume, letters of recommendation, et cetera. And then there'd be a screening by a panel and then another committee screening process, and then Governor Walker would make the final decision. And so this is something that does happen, but I think people are understandably critical because they think that if he appoints Bradley or whoever he would appoint to that seat, that person would have an advantage over the other two candidates who have announced that they are running.
So Governor Walker has said that Tommy Thompson did this as well. He appointed judges. That this is not out of the ordinary that I would do this thing as well. In this case, the election is very close. I believe it's in April. Was it also the case where it was just a matter of months into a 10-year term as for Tommy Thompson and his appointments?
So I don't recall exactly how long they had to sit out, but it is, the election comes within a short period of time. And so the appointments are not, you know, for the entire term. Yeah, or whatever's left in the remainder of the term. So say if Justice Crooks had been in the fifth year of his 10-year term, there would be it would trigger an election for that vacancy.
So with this election in April, it's, you know, again, matter of months away into a 10-year term. So given that, you know, with critics saying this would give one candidate a leg up, since it is such a short amount of time, do you think that argument still holds water?
that it gives. Yeah. Oh, sure. Absolutely. So, and it would hold water in many instances because judicial elections, even at the Supreme Court, and this is kind of a high saliency election because the vacancy occurred under somewhat, you know, tragic, one would say, circumstances, and so people are aware of how Justice Crooks died. I think that, and so people are paying attention to this, but I think that even given that, they're typically, voters don't turn out, they don't pay a lot of attention, and there's low voter turnout for judicial elections. So being able to say that you have served as a Supreme Court justice, or you've sat, you know, in this appointee position as an interim, does give people this, like, oh, well, you know how to do the job. That's a cue. You know what to do. So, you know, that is an advantage, absolutely.
We're talking with Jolly Emery right now from UW-Whitewater. We're talking about news that Governor Walker might appoint Appeals Court Judge Rebecca Bradley to the open position on the state Supreme Court. And as you said, the deadline for this vacancy to apply is this Friday. Do you think it's likely that anybody else is going to apply by then?
You know, that's a really good question. So this is a, you know, it hasn't been something that has been given a very long length of time with respect to, you know, the application process. It's a very short window. People would have to be prepared to do this, even though candidates announce fairly quickly after they learned that Justice Crooks would not be running for reelection. Their names started, you know, coming out pretty quickly, their announcements that they'd be running. So you have to be ready to go. And it's interesting that with respect to all the news reports that I've read, Bradley is the one person who isn't saying that she would not apply for the appointment. And again, even if other people do go through the application process for appointment, it does appear that she would be a top choice for him, if not his only choice in this instance.
Well, let's talk about the stakes for a moment. How would the appointment of Justice Bradley change the makeup of the state Supreme Court?
Well, that's a really good question, too. So in the past, Justice Crooks, by some people, has been called the swing vote, and even others refer to him as the liberal vote because he would often vote along with the liberal bloc on the court. There is a conservative majority on the court. There has been for a while now, and adding Bradley to the court would just solidify that conservative bloc. She'd be one more conservative vote.
And any issues that you see coming up where that could be a key factor?
Well, you know, there are, there are some various issues that are involving state workers, issues that are involving other things that haven't had the door closed. The most important cases that the court was dealing with lately that had a lot of state and national interest, the court has already decided, and they've been decided in the conservative bloc's favor. So, I think we would predict that Governor Walker would appoint a conservative to the court. So any decisions that the court's going to make, they're going to be in the conservative direction.
So given that some people say this is the handwriting on the wall, when could we expect an appointment from Governor Walker?
Well, I would assume fairly soon. So people are predicting maybe even as early as next week. So part of that's going to depend upon how many applications he gets. Then the vetting process, there's also an interview, but those things, you know, can be done by telephone. I'm thinking that maybe next week we'll learn about the appointment.
Well, we'll be watching. Jolly, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you for calling.
That was Jolly Emery, Chair and Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She joined us to talk about the news that Governor Walker may appoint Appeals Court Judge Rebecca Bradley to the open position on the state Supreme Court.
Our next guest went for a big drive earlier this month. Nothing unusual there. He drove around Lake Michigan, a little bigger deal, but still not an uncommon road trip. But he did it on an electric motorcycle, which, as far as anyone can tell, is a first.
The intrepid adventurer was Ben Nelson of Oconomowoc. He did his Loop the Lake tour at the beginning of September. He's an actor, director, and tinkerer, and the creator of the DVD Build Your Own Electric Motorcycle. And he joins us from our Milwaukee studio. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So why did you decide to set out on this tour?
Well, it had to do with a couple of things. One is I'm actually friends with a guy who set cross-country Guinness Book of World Records going across the country. But I figured, what's the point of going from one side to the other? When you're done, you just got to go back again. Wouldn't it make more sense? Maybe going in a circle instead. That way, wherever I end up, it's right where I started from.
And why in particular on an electric motorcycle?
Well, I had gotten into electric vehicles a while back. In 2007, I built an electric motorcycle. I took old Kawasaki and I converted it to electric. Before that, I had built an electric bicycle, but from a kit, and that went back to just the fact that every time I got a new car, it got worse fuel economy and leaked more oil than the last one did. So I'm not really a traditional motorcyclist either. I built an electric motorcycle and took the motorcycle safety training class at Waukesha County Technical College. And on the last day of my class, I showed up with my electric motorcycle and showed it to the instructors. And not only did they love it, but all the maneuvers we had to practice in the class, I could do one-handed because there was no clutch to slip and there was no engine to kill. So it's actually great for things like an Independence Day parade.
How did it change your journey riding an electric motorcycle going around the lake? How would it have been different with a traditional gas bike?
Well, I'd never really done a long-distance trip on a motorcycle before. I'd never toured on any motorcycle, whether gas or electric. But compared to a typical gas trip, it was really just a different pace. This vehicle was originally an electric motorcycle that I got cheap because it didn't run. And that was my winter project, was learning how to fix it up and get it to work. And then I actually upgraded the batteries with some batteries from a crashed Nissan Leaf electric car from a junkyard. And it had about a 60-plus mile range, anywhere up to 90 miles per charge. You know, that'd be more like just zipping around in the city, like 60-some miles out in the country and going freeway speeds. But the pace was very different. You know, I would stop and recharge about every 60 miles. And of course, I planned for that. So I decided I was going to look at a map and say, oh, wow, there's a really great state park here. Oh, look at this. Boy, this is a really neat small town. You know what? I've never been there. I've never been into the Upper Peninsula. I haven't been to much of the Lower Peninsula, the main state of Michigan. So it was really a different pace. But it was very enjoyable. I was doing about 150 miles a day, and if I did it again, I'd probably do about 100 miles a day just to give me more time to check out all the cool places. I never had to wait for the motorcycle to be recharged. The motorcycle was already charged up and ready to go before I was. I was always the one saying, no, I want to stick around here a little while. But I also kind of had a schedule because I was going to be meeting up with a couple of friends, and at one point we actually formed a 3-person electric motorcycle gang, and that was absolutely a blast as well.
Talking to Ben Nelson of Oconomowoc about his trip around Lake Michigan. He looped the lake on his electric motorcycle. So you were partly doing this to prove a point, one, that you can do long trips on electric vehicles, motorcycles or cars. Along the way, did you find enough infrastructure, or do you think we need more to accommodate electric vehicles on the roads?
Well, certainly there's a lot of public electric vehicle charging near the cities. You know, in Milwaukee, we've got some electric vehicle charging. More would be nice. In Chicago, it's everywhere. It's just absolutely everywhere. There's even at one of the outlet malls along I-94, there's a Tesla supercharger. So if you're lucky enough to have one of those electric cars, you can charge about 200 miles in 20 to 30 minutes. But if you get into the Upper Peninsula, there is zero infrastructure for public charging. There are, however, some really great state parks. So the very first thing I did, I already had my Wisconsin State Park sticker, and when I got to the UP, I got my Michigan State Park sticker. And part of this, too, it was going to be a camping trip. I didn't have a budget for staying at any fancy hotels or anything, so I packed up my tent and my sleeping bag, and I would stay overnight at campgrounds, and so many campgrounds nowadays have electricity, so I was just able to plug into an electric outlet there. I had even modified the motorcycle to have extra chargers on it, so it would have a maximum 2-hour recharge time. So during the day, I could stop at a state park, go over to the campground, plug in, and then have lunch, check out the park, see the beach, the dunes, the observation tower, whatever they had there at the state park. The other places I ended up charging that I hadn't really thought about, but they just kind of happened as part of the trip, was casinos, believe it or not, and also marinas. There's a lot of places right on Lake Michigan where they have shore power for boats coming in, and instead I plugged my electric motorcycle in there. One of those surprising things that I learned on the trip.
So did you have to plan all of that, all those stops ahead of time, or did you just kind of trust your luck?
Well, I kind of had a one-page map with a bunch of scribbles on it, and I knew I was going to do about 150 miles a day. So I actually planned two charging stops per day about 50 miles apart. Of course, that never works out exactly. So I had some rough ideas. But when I was going across the Upper Peninsula on Highway 2, there was one day where I literally did not know how I was going to get across. I just knew I'd have to find more than just a regular electric outlet, a couple of circuits to charge at once. And I actually ended up at the public marina in Nabobin, Michigan, which turned out to be a real gem. I never would have known it was there other than just having my little GPS map with me and zooming in far enough until it said public marina right at the end of the peninsula. So I went right out onto the pier, plugged in my motorcycle. I even got a ride back to town. I had a great evening at a little coffee shop called The Anchor there. Had a pasty, some delicious local Youper food, and heard some live music. And by the time it was dinner, I just went done with dinner. I went back to my bike. It was all charged up, and I finished my trip for the day.
Briefly, Ben, do you have another epic journey planned?
Oh, man, I don't know. I mean, this was pretty exciting. It was pretty neat. I do wonder about going all the way around Lake Superior. It's bigger. It's further. It's more rural. It was really a lot of fun. I don't know what the next thing is. You know, frankly, the next big adventure might just be putting solar panels on the roof of my garage. I've done the math, and for about $12,000, I will never have to pay an electric bill for the rest of my life, and I can power an electric car off of it, save a lot of money on gasoline in the long run, too.
Well, Ben, sounds like an amazing journey. Thanks so much for talking about it with us today.
My pleasure being here.
That was Ben Nelson of Oconomowoc talking about his Loop the Lake tour around Lake Michigan on an electric motorcycle.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking forward,
when it comes to the Great Lakes states, places like Michigan, Ohio, and even Wisconsin, there's a perception out there that economically these states can't really compete with the powerhouse cities and regions on the east and west coasts.
But our next guest says, not so fast. These perceptions, he says, are becoming increasingly outdated as the Great Lakes region comes back strong from the Great Recession. In a new piece, he lays out what the region is doing right and what work still needs to be done.
Joel Kotkin joins us now. He's a distinguished fellow in urban studies at Chapman University and executive editor of newgeography.com and executive director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. His recent piece is called The Comeback of the Great Lakes States. Joel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Well, so a lot of times the Great Lakes states, they're portrayed as flyover country. And you're saying there's actually a lot happening here. What piqued your interest in what's happening in the Great Lakes states?
Well, one of the things I do is I track the demographic trends with my colleagues. And one of the things that we found that was very, very interesting is particularly when we looked at 25 to 34 migration, that there had been a real uptick, particularly since 2010, in cities that you might consider or might historically be considered Rust Belt cities. I'm looking at, for instance, Pittsburgh did second. Cleveland did very well. There's definitely a trend where, Milwaukee, for instance, grew as much as San Francisco, despite the tech boom. So, I mean, what you're really seeing is that I think the big thing that's going on is that the coasts have gotten to a point that they're so expensive that, really very difficult to buy a house, very difficult to start a business, and that a considerable number of young people are moving either back to the Midwest or moving from here to the Midwest. Not uncommon for me living in Southern California to hear people say, well, my kids are living in Indianapolis. And that process is pretty well gone. Then you also have basic things like, you guys have water, which we don't. You also have to a large extent, you know, a strong industrial base. You have a lot of skills. Of the Great Lakes have the biggest concentration of scientists and engineers in the country. So they've got a lot going for them. I mean, you know, they're coming out of a very deep hole, but they're pretty far along. And we have to take a look at it this way: the unemployment rate in the Great Lakes states are actually lower than on either coast.
Now, just to take the first thing you started with, saying that the people are moving to these cities and away from expensive cities like San Francisco, L.A., for instance, isn't that the opposite of what we hear in the headlines? That we hear in Wisconsin, we're having trouble getting young people to stay. We use the phrase brain drain a lot. You're saying right. The evidence says otherwise.
Well, the evidence is that is turning in a pretty significant way. The migration, the places where there's net migration at the highest level, both percentage-wise and numbers, really Chicago, L.A., and New York, New York in particular. New York has had a net out of about over 400,000 since 2010. You're not going to read that in the New York Times, okay? You're just not. But that's what the census numbers will tell you. The middle part of the country has really not been able to make a convincing case for itself, and I think, you know, sometimes you'll see a little article saying, well, there's two blocks of Cleveland that are kind of like Brooklyn, you know, and so there must be some progress, without understanding that these places have some of their own strengths that draw people there. And, of course, there's also the issue of it's just become harder and harder and harder for a young family to get itself established on the coast just because of cost.
Now, you said that the resurgence of the industrial sort of manufacturing base that was here for a long time is part of what's driving this. But what is driving the industrial resurgence in the Midwest states?
Well, I think there are a lot of things. Now, of course, it's going to hit a little bit of a rough spot now because of the high dollar. But, I mean, you basically have automation, which means that you need skilled labor, but your labor content is less. The natural gas revolution, I think, was probably about the most important part because it drove the cost of electricity down. So, for instance, the cost of electricity for an industrial user in Germany can be two or three times what it is in Ohio. So you have that factor as well. You have much cheaper electricity. Labor costs are about the same as they are in, let's say, Japan and large parts of Europe. And even China has gotten to be, you know, considerably more expensive. And lastly, something that a German car maker who had established in some facilities here, and particularly in Alabama, but also in the Midwest, he said one of the big problems is a lot of companies are becoming very wary about building things in China because they feel they can't protect their intellectual property.
Well, we're talking right now with Joel Kotkin of NewGeography.com, and he says the Great Lakes states are experiencing a big economic rebound with industries like manufacturing, energy, and engineering leading the way. And Joel, what kind of job growth have these Great Lakes states seen?
Fairly good job growth, particularly Ohio has been very strong. Iowa seems to be doing reasonably well. Most of them are doing at or above the national average. The only one that seems to have been lagging, on a consistent basis is Illinois, and because Illinois has got its own problems.
Well, let's look at Wisconsin in particular. What do you see when you look at Wisconsin? We've been talking a lot on this show and in the state as a statewide conversation about jobs. Are we seeing the jobs? Well, let's start there. How is Wisconsin doing?
Well, first of all, I mean, the obviously the star in Wisconsin is Madison, and Madison is doing very, very well economically. Always, and I do the rankings for Forbes for best cities for jobs, and Madison is consistently towards the top. And you know, I've been out to the Epic campus outside of Madison, and you know, that's a Silicon Valley like company out there. And you have some areas of strength, you know, really throughout the state. You have some inner city areas that are lagging behind, but overall, you know, Wisconsin's got, you know, fairly educated population, relatively low degree of poverty. You know, one of the things that my colleague Dick Morrill over at the University of Washington has done is he's traced, you know, what parts of the country have the highest levels of equality and which ones don't. And statewide, Wisconsin actually comes out looking fairly good, although, you know, Milwaukee definitely has its challenges. But that's, you know, predominantly because Wisconsin still has the heritage of being predominantly sort of Scandinavian German culture, which is tends to be more egalitarian. Actually, if you want to look at the most equal parts of America, they're almost entirely the areas that are most heavily German and Scandinavian. So you can maybe you can make the point that, you know, they had to be hardy enough to live in that climate. You know, there's a lot of ways of looking at it. But Wisconsin has a lot going for it. It has a fairly high education level, and obviously has a very good university, and has a very strong culture. I've been in many parts of Wisconsin, not just the big cities, you know, Green Bay, Kenosha, and I've been really quite impressed with how Wisconsin operates. And I think for a lot of people, particularly younger people, it is a place where you can live the kind of life that, you know, frankly, is becoming very difficult to live in Southern California, the Bay Area, or New York, you know, unless you really struck it rich or robbed a bank or have rich parents.
Now, it's great to think of the Great Lakes states bouncing back, but is it more than just a local bounce? Is this affecting, say, companies around the world and the workforce?
Well, I think it is something that is happening in terms of, you know, people looking from all over the world and looking at where can I invest, where I can get the greatest return. And a lot of the Midwest states, you know, Ohio is probably the one that's done best, but there's a lot of investment into Michigan. People are looking, let's say, on the global level. I was just talking to somebody here in Southern California where you know, some of the Korean car makers have their U.S. headquarters. And a lot of them are sending many of their middle-level jobs and their engineering jobs to the Midwest, where they say, look, we can get a good engineer for, you know, $110,000 a year. Maybe his spouse or her spouse is making about the same. And, you know, for $200,000 a year, you can live really well. $200,000 a year in the Bay Area, you know, doesn't really get you very much.
We're talking right now with Joel Kotkin of NewGeography.com. He says the Great Lakes states are experiencing a big economic rebound with industries like manufacturing, energy, and engineering leading the way.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this idea that the Great Lakes region is seeing a strong economic comeback? If you live in Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois, or right here in Wisconsin, what have you seen? And on a personal level, are you one of the people that he talked about who might have considered living on a coast, but it's too expensive, and you pick the Midwest instead?
We're talking with Joel Kotkin of NewGeography.com. He says the Great Lakes states are experiencing an economic rebound, and we're looking at what these states are doing right and possible trends to come in the near future.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin and other Great Lakes states are poised for a big economic success in the coming years? What industries lead the way where you live, and what still needs to be done? And what's your story? How do you fit into all this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, and we go to our callers now. We've got Ashley with us in Coloma. Ashley, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say I agree with your guest completely. I used to live in California, and we moved 3 years ago to Wisconsin because it's too expensive, and there was no way to secure a future for us or for our family. And we lived in Northern California in a small town, which was much less expensive than the coast. And since moving, we've been able to make a difference and buy a house. So it's been a good choice for us.
And how did you pick Coloma?
Well, we started in southern Wisconsin and had been saving for a few years, knowing that we wanted to buy a house. And we want to have a small farm. And this was the perfect town for that. We liked the small town feeling and found a nice affordable house with a nice small piece of property where we could have a few animals.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much. Thank you for sharing your story. We appreciate that. And Joel, does that sound like a case in point of what you're telling us here?
definitely. You know, one unfortunate thing is, you know, I've been around for a while, and people used to do these things in the Bay Area or in L.A. They would go, and I remember friends of my father had a little farm up in Petaluma. Well, you couldn't buy a farm in Petaluma now for less than $5-10 million. I mean, and they were, you know, they were a family with 8 kids, you know, a big, you know, big family, living in the countryside in, he worked in San Francisco, it was about an hour and 10-minute drive. That kind of alternative is increasingly difficult to get. The way that you do it in California today, if you don't have inherited money, is you hope that you bought a house 20 or 30 years ago, it's appreciated, and you stay in the market. But once you leave, as the song goes, you can never come back. And so there's a tremendous amount of pressure on people to make that decision, particularly as they get into their mid-30s, start thinking about having a family, thinking about buying a house, maybe thinking about starting a business. And that option is increasingly very difficult in California. It's becoming difficult in the Northwest. And obviously, it's also quite difficult in the New York or Boston areas.
Thank you for that call. And we're going to go next to Patty in La Crosse. Hi, Patty.
Hello.
What is your story?
Well, I just recently moved from Michigan, and with that, I left a job of 22 years in manufacturing and came to the La Crosse area and was able to find employment quite easily. There's low unemployment in La Crosse, great job opportunities for professionals, and I just find it to be an absolutely beautiful area.
Well, Patty, thanks a lot. Appreciate your story there, too. And Joel, you said that Michigan is kind of the star when it comes to a lot of what we're talking about here. Patty saying that the La Crosse here in Wisconsin had some things edging it up.
Well, you know, I mean, Michigan has had a really tremendous turnaround. And, you know, part of it is also, you know, these things are cyclical. The Great Lakes State lost so much of their population that they're going to tend to have a little bit less of an unemployment problem just because so many people have left, that there are fewer people there to take the job. So there's definitely, and this is something that happens all over in American history. You know, you have an area starts to depopulate. They start focusing more on their competitiveness. The labor market begins to tighten a bit, and people start moving back. And I think that, you know, when we look at the next, you know, 20, 30 years in this country, I think we're going to see that people are going to make a choice to move to a broad swath of the country, everything from the Intermountain West to the Great Lakes to the Third Coast, the area around the Gulf of Mexico. All those places are consistently getting very strong in migration from other parts of the country. And the days when you would look at a chart and you would always expect it that the cities in the Great Lakes would lead in out-migration, some of them still have that problem, but nothing on the scale that for instance, you know, New York has in terms of losing people.
We're talking to Joel Kotkin right now of NewGeography.com about why he says the Great Lakes States are experiencing a bump right now, an economic boom. And Joel, looking into your crystal ball, how bright is this future or this reality that you're seeing now, and what kind of challenges to its continuance do you see?
Well, I think there are going to be several big challenges. In the short run, obviously the high dollar is going to make it hard for U.S. companies that export. And I know that Wisconsin, which has a very high percentage of manufacturing and some very high-end manufacturing, could be threatened by that. So that's certainly going to be a challenge in the future. Another challenge would be is if we have a very radical phase out of coal and even of natural gas, and that's going to be very tough on a lot of these economies which depend on relatively cheap energy. So, you know, some of the regulatory challenges, particularly coming from Washington, could threaten some of this expansion. And of course, there's going to be some major adjustments. I mean, one of the things we're also seeing, which I haven't mentioned, is immigrants are beginning to move to places like Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, because you know what? They're not stupid. They know where there are job opportunities, and they also know where, you know, having a job actually can pay off for you to have a house. So I think that, that for these states, which have been homogeneous, let's say, since the 1920s, largely homogeneous, or 20s or 30s, are now going to have to adjust to being places where there's a big Hispanic population, big Asian population. And I think that's going to be a bit of a challenge.
And we've got to leave it there. Joel, thank you so much for joining us. Interesting stuff.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
That was Joel Kotkin, Distinguished Fellow in Urban Studies at Chapman University. He's Executive Director of the Center for Opportunity Urbanism. He joined us to talk about his recent piece called The Comeback of the Great Lakes States.